On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark about her new book, Encounters with Star People.
I think we assume, whether this is true or not, that in American Indian cultures, there's a different set of givens, a different orientation regarding the spirit world.
Well, I think, again, you have to separate tribes. There are some tribes that it's forbidden to even speak the name of a dead person, where in other tribes, they believe that when someone dies, they stay with them for a year. Their spirit remains with them for a year. So it's difficult for me to say that as a general rule that it has a spiritual connection, but definitely it does with some of the tribes.
I think that worldview puts you in a completely different place in terms of dealing with the UFO phenomena.
Oh, I do too, because Native people on a whole are accepting of it. They aren't skeptical of it. So if you approach it from a perspective that it is part of the universe and that it's nothing to fear, then that's one view. But to be skeptical of it and not believe what you're seeing or deny that it occurs is a totally different worldview.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to talk about the ET phenomena. You know, I mentioned in the last show that this is an area that I see myself being drawn to more and more, and as I look back, you know, I'm really surprised at how resistant I've been to exploring this topic more fully. And even though I've been interested in UFOs and some of the more important cases that provide overwhelming evidence that something is going on, I've been reluctant to go all the way and explore the full ramifications of contact. But now I think I'm ready to overcome that reluctance and jump into this field and try and figure out what's going on. So today's interview with Dr. Artie Clark sets the groundwork, if you will, for deeper exploration of the full implications of this contact that seems to be going on with these other beings. Here's my dialogue with Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark. Today we welcome author and professor emeritus from Montana State University, Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, to Skeptico. Dr. Clark has a long, distinguished academic career working with indigenous populations and is here to talk about her fascinating new book, Encounters with Star People. Dr. Clark, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Clark, start out. Tell us about your book, obviously how you came to write it, maybe a little bit about the methodology you used. You've worked for a long time with Native Americans and are familiar with some of the cultural aspects of that. But how'd you come to write this book?
Well, when I first came to Montana State University, one of my roles, in addition to teaching, was I was the director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education. And what the center did was I would write grants through the center to recruit Native students to come to Montana State University to become teachers and principals and superintendents. And I had gone out to one of the reservations in Montana and had met with a group of students, and the person who helped me out on site invited me out to dinner, and after dinner he said to me, do you have some time? I want to show you something. And I said, sure. And he took me up in the mountains above his village, and he parked his car, and he reached over and he got a pair of binoculars, and he said to me, come, if we're lucky, they'll come. And I said, who will come? And he said, well, the ancestors. And so we sat on this boulder and we watched the night sky, and he told me stories about things that had happened to him in his life of his interaction with star people. Well, I had heard these stories when I was a little girl, as well. And so when I left the reservation that night, all the way back to the university I was thinking about, I've heard these stories. He's heard these stories. How many other Native people have heard stories from and have stories to tell? So I traveled a great deal, both going to conferences and speaking at conferences and conventions, and also going out to do research and to recruit. And so what I did is I started just putting out feelers. And, you know, if I went out to dinner with people in the evening, I'd say, do any of you have star stories? Have any of you ever had experiences with star people, or have you seen UFOs or anything like that? So I began collecting stories. And over the time, I almost collected 1,000 stories in a 20-year period. And they range from stories among Native Americans in the United States, in the 48 states in Alaska, because I grouped Hawaii with a South Pacific group, because many of their stories were very similar to what I was finding throughout the South Pacific, including Australia and New Zealand. And then I focused on the Maya in Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico. So, and although I did have stories that came from the Zapotec, the majority of my stories that came from Central America and Mexico involved the Maya people. So that's how I got started, and that's I had basically just put the research away. At the university, I had other things to do, and this was just my own personal interest. It was done on my own personal time. And so I decided, when I retired from the university, I had an offer to come out of retirement and, to another, a reservation. A tribe contacted me and asked me if I would come out of retirement and do a major project for them. It was a 5-year project, and I had gone back to Washington, D.C. because it involved a huge grant. And I'd gone back to D.C. and been trained on what they expected me to do. And then I went to the reservation. And while I was on the reservation, I had lunch with a group of women. And I was still trying to decide whether I wanted to take this job or not, because a 5-year commitment is a really long time, and it involved a lot of travel and a lot of time spent away from home. And so as I was having lunch with this group of women, we began to talk. I don't know, the subject of UFOs came up for some reason, and I began to tell them some of the stories that I had collected. And one of them said, "Well, what are you going to do with this?" And I said, "Well, probably nothing." And she said, "Well, you can't do that. This is a part of our oral history. You have to put this down so that people will know." And so on my way back home, I got to thinking, do I want to spend the next 5 years of my life doing research and evaluation, which is what I've been doing for 30 years at Montana State University, or do I want to write this book? And obviously, I chose the latter. I decided to write the book, and not only to write this one, but I hope to do two more. One on the Maya, and the indigenous people of Central America and Mexico, and one on the indigenous people of the South Pacific.
Well, fantastic. And it sounds like you certainly have a lot of material. You know, before we jump too far ahead, I thought the first part of that account that you just gave was rather interesting, and that's that these stories immediately resonated with your own personal history. And
right.
Again, if we pull that out of the context, you know, I don't know that most people in the United States today, or in Europe, or in the Western world would at all relate to the idea of being connected to the star people. What do you make of that? What did that stir up in you? I mean, what had you done with that?
Well, you know, as I was growing up as a child, you know, my grandmother told me a story that the star men came to Earth and that they lived with the sun women. The sun women were the people, women of Earth. And that a time came when the star men had to leave the Earth, and that the women of Earth were very, very upset. And so a council was held, and it was decided that those who wanted to stay could stay behind, and those who wanted to return to the stars could return to the stars. So my grandmother would say to me that you are a descendant of those, the star people, and the people of Earth, and that all of us have a special plan for us on this Earth for that reason. And so that was just, for me, it was a story that I was told. And as I grew older, of course, I put those stories away. They were the stories of my childhood. And when I became an adult, it had no impact on my life that I know until I met this individual who told me his personal story. And of course, that brought back all of these stories of my childhood.
Sure. And I just think that that kind of gets at, you know, something that's right below the surface of this book, because one of the reasons we get excited about this book, that is to hear the stories from Native Americans, is that we think as non-Native Americans that there's something different about this culture, something different about their orientation to the world, to their worldview. And maybe that's true, maybe that's not true. I'm sure it's both. But I think we have to kind of be careful with how we unpack that, don't we? I mean, especially you as someone who spent your professional academic career kind of in both worlds at Montana State University and academia, but also in working with indigenous people. How do we kind of approach that with sensitivity, but also with a desire to gain the benefit of the cultural differences as well?
Well, and I think that's the thing that I was always sensitive to. You know, first of all, I didn't want to be branded at Montana State University as some psycho professor, you know, who was out there advocating, you know, beliefs in UFOs. But at the same time, in the Native community, I wanted to be, credible, and I think that was the key to my success with Native people, is that what I did is I just put feelers out. I didn't go and attempt to coerce anyone into telling their stories. Some of the people, as I revealed in the book, I'd known 25 years before they ever told me their story. It was that waiting and watching, and even though I was Native myself, or part Native, there was that credibility test that I had to pass before the stories came forth. And I hope that that shows in the book that the people who confided in me were people who trusted me.
Do you have maybe an example from the book of where that was the case, where someone didn't come forward for maybe a long time and then came forward with a pretty amazing story?
Well, I think the story that Harrison tells of the craft that crash landed on his grandfather's ranch in a remote section of the reservation. And the survivors lived there until they were rescued sometime later. And he took me to the ranch. He showed me where the event occurred. He told me about how when he was a boy, he had boarded the craft, and what he saw and what he felt. His grandfather, he wanted to remove things from the craft, and his grandfather wouldn't allow it because he said it was sacred. And then having the Corps of Engineers come in at a later time and build a dam, which literally destroyed any evidence of the craft. And his grandfather always believed that as they were excavating the land there, that they had discovered the craft and had taken it away. Now, this was back in the 40s, and obviously, when I talked to him about it, he said, you know, there were very few cars on the reservation at that time. He said people would stand beside the road and just watch this equipment go by because they were so enthralled and fascinated just by the size of the equipment and the vehicles that were passing by. And so he said they could remove anything, and his grandfather always felt that that's what had happened. But his grandfather was also very pleased that he had kept their secret, that he had somehow protected them from the outside world, and that they had lived there free of observation and free of detection on his land, and he was the one who had done that. So, and I had known Harrison for 25 years. I had gone onto the reservation as a consultant, sent there by the university because the community, the school district in the community was attempting to get a bilingual education grant funded from the federal government because they had a number of children in the school district that did not speak English. They spoke only the native language. Harrison resented that. He was a cultural person and the one that everybody turned to. So he resented a university, what he considered a university interference. And so it took time to gain his trust. And over the years, we became close and became friends. But it took him 25 years before he told me the story. And I have no doubt whatsoever that what he told me was true.
Well, let's get to that. And I think that you have a certain credibility, obviously, that comes through not only with the Native American tribes, but in your work, a longtime, highly regarded academic who is not only familiar with the university, but is working with government programs and has the credibility that goes with that. But I do think it's interesting in a couple of ways. I mean, it sounds like you're the only person who really could have written this book. I mean, one, it takes a certain tenacity to stay with this thing for that long, but also the kind of trust that's required, that what comes through is that these folks who you collected these stories from don't fit the normal profile of people who are putting forth a UFO story, either because it was the most traumatic thing in their life or because they have some other kind of ulterior motive. It sounds like that there was a different agenda here in terms of these people. They had basically, a lot of them have incorporated into their life just fine and brought it out because you probed, right?
Right. I think, you know, it was a story that they had shared perhaps with family and friends. Some of them had never told anyone. But I think just my presence, and they told me their stories. I never tried to interject any personal opinions into what they were telling me. I let them tell the stories without judgment. I'm a social scientist, I'm not in the hard sciences, so I wasn't demanding in terms of, well, where's your proof? Where's your proof? You know, you got to have some kind of proof. And I wasn't looking for that. I was looking, you tell me your story. You tell me what happened, and I will listen.
You did something that's much more valuable, is you just gathered a lot of these first-person accounts, and when we really sort through them and sift through them, we can start looking for the same kind of patterns that let us know whether they're reliable accounts. I mean, I think that's a lot better than tracking down some ticky-tacky photos or little remnants that someone has of it. I mean, I guess I don't want to say that, because both can be valuable, and you do have some first-person experience that you had with trace phenomena and all the rest of that. So all of it's good.
Now, I think both approaches are valuable, but I think that hard science often criticizes social scientists, you know, and I've had some of that, you know, but I didn't set out from the perspective of trying to attack or criticize or delve into motivations or, you know, where's your proof that this happened, that kind of thing. I just recorded the stories. And I think because of that, I got some very honest, open accounts of what occurred. And, of course, one of the things, I think the trust that came along with that is that the guarantee that I would not reveal the identity of the individuals. Now, along the road or down the road, if someone of them wants to come forward and said, hey, I'm the person in Dr. Clark's book, that's fine. But I committed to anonymity, and I intend to honor that. many of the people who actually told me the stories are, you know, have passed now because, you know, these stories go back 20, 25 years.
What's been the reaction from within the Native American community about the book?
Nothing. I haven't heard anything from the Native community.
Anything positive, like they want more stories, or negative, like, you know, gee, I wish you wouldn't have brought that out, or...
I haven't heard anything from the Native, really, nothing from the Native community. I've had a couple emails attacking me because I used the term American Indians in the book instead of Native American, and saying, you know, if you're really a Native American, you wouldn't call Indians American Indians. Although the book, in the very front of the book, I explained why I used the term American Indian because, you know, several years ago, back when I was still in academia, there were a group of us who were Native researchers who decided that that we were no longer going to use the term Native American in our discussion in general about Native Americans because we based it upon the fact that the term Native American was increasingly being claimed by those individuals who were born within the United States, regardless of their ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
So when we would say we were Native American, you know, somebody who was not of American Indian heritage would say, well, I'm a Native American too. I was born.
Right.
And so
I'm six generations Native American. Right.
So what we decided to do along with the award-winning journalist Tim Gallego, who is a founder and editor of the Lakota Times and Indian Country Today and Native Sun News, we decided that even though Indian is a misnomer,
of course, right,
for generic purposes, that we were going to use the term American Indian, because anybody who really politically correct thinker who believes Native American is the preferred identification tag for any tribe, I think is wrong, and that we prefer to be called Lakota or Northern Cheyenne or, you know, by our names, but if not, you know, American Indian is an acceptable term because of the Native American, and I think rightfully so, that people who are born here have the right to consider themselves Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so there have been some attacks along that way toward me, but obviously the people who attacked me hadn't read the book, or at least not my explanation of why I used that term.
Right. What's been the reaction from within the UFO community?
If you're talking about the UFO community of the people who are in power and the people who are, you know, that you see their names at conferences and total silence, Whitley Strieber has certainly been positive, but I'm not sure he's a part of that community as such. My readers have been just absolutely, I mean, they have been unbelievable. The accolades and reviews and comments and emails I get have been not one negative one from any of those.
You know where I'd like to go next? Because when I say UFO community, and then, you know, that's a nebulous term, like you just said, who's in the UFO
right.
community and all the rest of that. But I do think that the UFO phenomena, the ET phenomena, is really an important part of what's evolving as our culture, our understanding of who we are, obviously how we fit into the world, what this thing called consciousness is. So what I thought was kind of interesting about your book, without even this being a purpose of your book, is you kind of shatter some of the paradigms that are most prevalent within that UFO community. For example, let's start with the whole origin of the ET phenomena. There's this debate, you know, did the ETs arrive in 1947 with the explosion of the nuclear bomb and then the crash at Roswell? Is this a recent phenomena? What would your accounts, your over 1,000 first-person accounts, tell us about answering that question, about the when question in terms of this phenomena?
Well, I think for a majority of the people I interviewed, their opinion is they've always been here. That it's not a new phenomena, that they have been visiting Earth for many, many eons. One person said before the beginning of time, when he was telling me the stories, some of the ancient stories, he said these stories go back before the beginning of time. They are the old, old stories. And of course, I don't include those in the book, but what he was saying to me is that this is nothing new. We've always had interaction with the people from the stars. But you also met other people from different tribes who had no connection or no stories that were related to that. So it would appear that depending upon the tribal group, that also varied. I mean, I had the one story, and I don't know if you read it, the young man who told me about his grandfather who, when he was a young man, helped bury an alien in the desert. And this was before Roswell.
I don't remember the story. Can you
remember the young man who told me about his grandfather that buried the alien? And along with some other teenage boys, they found him wandering in the desert and he died and they just buried him and never told anyone because they considered that star person to be, you know, a messenger from God or from the sky gods. And so they buried him. It's just, you know, a totally different kind of relationship that we're talking about here.
Another aspect of the ET, UFO phenomena that we're constantly trying to get our arms around, once you cross the chasm and say, okay, there is something here that we need to study and we need to understand, but let's jump over there because all the rest is kind of silly to ignore it. And that is, are we talking about a nuts and bolts phenomena, i.e. flying saucers and vehicles and beings, or are we talking about a consciousness phenomenon, interdimensional, a mind control dream kind of phenomena, or is it both? What does your research tell you?
I think it's a combination of both. I found that to be present, particularly in some of the Maya stories, that traveling back and forth between dimensions. In fact, sometimes I think when I was listening to some of the Maya elders that probably the Mayans were the first time travelers because they seem to have that ability or at least that knowledge of how to travel back and forth. But then, you know, you look at some of the Black Elk also had that ability, you know, the Great Sioux, Medicine Man. And so, you know, I don't know if I think that for the most of the people in that our stories are recorded in my book, they were the nuts and bolts kinds of things. But I find that what's most interesting about them is they weren't channeling somebody. They weren't under hypnosis. They were telling stories as they remembered them. They were not, you know, under some kind of hypnotic spell. And
yeah, that's fascinating. Let's touch on the potential agenda here, which is, of course, speculative and a tricky topic to even approach. But I was listening to the other day to a presentation by a UFO researcher, Barbara Lamb, who's done regression therapy work with over 1,000 people who claim to have had contact with aliens. And she, like many others, has the distinct impression that there's some kind of interbreeding, a hybridization process going on here. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I had no stories of that among American Indians, but I did encounter it in Mexico and in Guatemala of women who claim to have been abducted and to have borne hybrid children. I had one young woman tell me the story that she had been in the plaza one evening with her boyfriend and her friends. She was 16 at the time. Her boyfriend was 16. They were walking back home and walking back to their house and to her house, and both of them were taken, and she told me how they struggled because they were being pulled up into the sky. And how they struggled and kicked and clawed and tried to get away. And then the next day, she realizes she's pregnant and she's never had sex. So she and her boyfriend decide that it's a virgin birth, just like the Virgin Mary. They were very, very strong, devout Catholics, that it must be a virgin birth. And so he decides that he has to marry her, because if he marries her, then there will be no one in the village. She won't be criticized or isolated or shunned by other people. And he will go ahead and marry her and take to protect her, because he knows that it's a virgin birth. And a few weeks later, as the ceremony is being planned and they're planning on getting married, she's abducted again. And when she wakes up the next day, she's no longer pregnant.
And of course, those kind of accounts directly relate to so many accounts that other UFO researchers, John Mack at Harvard, Bud Hopkins, just many, many very credible UFO researchers have found the same thing. So it's interesting that you've run across that as well.
Well, and I ran across more than one case. I had a wonderful guide and who came across, he knew what I was doing, and he was taking me to these different sites. Actually, back when I was about 15 years old, a librarian handed me this book called The Incidences of Travel in the Yucatan. It was by two explorers, 19th century explorers by the name of Stevens and Catherwood, and they had gone, they had heard rumors of these great cities in the jungles of Mexico and Central America that had been built, and they went there in search of them. And of course, the book chronicles their trip. So I had promised myself when I was a teenager that one day I was going to follow in their footsteps and go to all these ancient cities. Well, then the years passed, of course, making a living and getting my degrees was took the forefront, and my dream of following Catherwood and Stevens through the jungles took a back seat.
Right.
But the day I retired from MSU, I was coming home and I saw a yard sale with a bunch of books stacked over in up against the garage door, and I can't pass that up. So I stopped my car, and here I found this one of these old books by Stevens. I thought, you know, this is something I have to do. And I set off, and I had read, you know, the works by von Daniken and different people who talked about the ancient astronauts and everything in these cities. And I had read the Popol Vuh and some of those things of the Maya. So I was interested in following up not only on Stevens and Catherwood, but also finding out firsthand the experiences of modern-day Maya with UFOs and of course, down there, most of them call them the sky gods. So that's what I set out to do. And of course, along the way, I had some wonderful people helping me. And I was actually taken to this village where six women came forth to tell me their stories. And this young woman who was now, you know, in her 20s, told me the story of what had happened to her. It was quite an interesting night. It was interesting, too, because of the lack of sophisticated methods of explaining things. Like, instead of talking about a UFO in terms, they would talk about two of the women talked about, they described the spacecraft as a gasoline tank that came down from the sky and sat there. And I found it extremely interesting to listen to the way they were describing these craft, because they didn't have television in their village. They didn't have all the things. They weren't exposed to the sci-fi movies and all the information that's out there. You know, I mean, they lived in, you know, on a hillside in Guatemala, you know, away from all of that. And so they describe, you know, and yet when you read UFO literature, you know about the pencil, cigar-shaped craft.
Right, right.
And here they are describing it as a gasoline tank, because that's what they've seen in their in their environment. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, that is very interesting. It speaks to all the kind of cultural flavoring that we imagine goes on in these accounts, especially when we look at the older accounts. You know, Artie, finally, what I wanted to kind of talk about was spirituality. again, if we unpack these experiences with the American Indians that you're talking about, we assume going in that there's a different spiritual orientation. I mean, you're in your professional career at Montana State University, you know, you have to walk a fine line like we all do. You know, you can't walk around and say, oh, of course, I believe in spirit communication and talking with the dead. In fact, everyone I know just assumes that that's a truth, right? I mean, we have this kind of cultural barrier in the West, regardless of any kind of religious background we may have, in terms of talking about and experiencing spirituality. And I think we assume, whether this is true or not, and you can maybe tell me if it is, but that in American Indian cultures, there's a different set of givens, a different set of, a different orientation regarding the spirit world. What would you first off kind of say about that? Is that true? Is that a misconception? And how might that play into these accounts and someone's receptivity to this kind of experience that they might have?
Well, I think, again, you have to separate tribes. There are some tribes that it's forbidden to even speak the name of a dead person, where in other tribes, they believe that when someone dies, they stay with them for a year. Their spirit remains with them for a year. And then after a year, they hold a ceremony to release that person. They have ceremonies where they can speak with those who have passed on. They have ceremonies where they can speak with the ancients, or where the ancients come to them and give them knowledge and answer their prayers or their questions. So it depends on the tribal group. And it varies greatly throughout the United States and Alaska. So it's difficult for me to say that as a general rule that it has a spiritual connection, but definitely it does with some of the tribes. There's no question about it that the ancestors see. Some of the tribes actually talk, and the Maya do this too. They talk about the trip across the Milky Way, that when you die, you cross the path as the Milky Way. See, that's what the Maya believe. They talk about going to Chavala. And so, you know, you've got a common theme there that the cosmos plays so much a part in afterlife and death and the ability of the dead or the deceased, that they never really die, that they just move on into another dimension, and that they can come back and communicate with the living.
Mm-hmm. See, I just think that no matter what kind of subtle differences you might have in that worldview, I think that worldview puts you in a completely different place in terms of dealing with the UFO phenomena. I have to tell
because Native people on a whole are accepting of it. They aren't skeptical of it.
Right, right.
So if you approach it from a perspective that it is part of the universe and that it's nothing to fear, then that's one view. But to be skeptical of it and not believe what you're seeing or deny that it occurs is a totally different worldview.
Right. Well, I think if you have that worldview that is so prevalent in our society, in our culture, and when you really deconstruct it, which is kind of what this show is about, really is not so much just deconstructing it from a UFO perspective, but from a straight scientific perspective. You know, you look at...
Well, that's what I was going to say. Don't you think that comes from the fact that modern day society is so controlled by the scientific evidence of everything, where the Native community is not?
I do think so, but I even think that that's somewhat of a misdirect, because I think that the best scientific evidence that we have for the last 100 years, all the scientific evidence in quantum physics has pointed us in the other direction, right? We've just chose to ignore it because the materialism that is so much a part of, you know, capitalism and the thing that we're in, that we live in, that we love, and our computers and all that pulls us the other way. So we can't possibly imagine what it would mean to give all that up. So we hold on to what's familiar. And again, it has all sorts of other implications as well. And so I guess we are coming to that same kind of point, maybe, that there is some reality to that when people have an orientation where they're free from that baggage, then kind of look at this and go, well, I don't know, but yeah, that happened. And, you know, it does relate to these other stories I've heard in my past. So it must be true. It isn't as hard to accept. Does that make it easier for them to incorporate it into their life without getting totally whacked out and thinking that...
Right, traumatized. I absolutely believe that's true, you know, because I've found very little evidence of trauma among the people that I interviewed. Maybe, certainly less than 10%, maybe less than 5%. You know, I never sat down and really took each story and put it in a category, but I think there was one instance I pointed out in the book where the young woman, her cousin had had an encounter and she had witnessed it, and therefore she just was really had difficulty dealing with it, and in fact had dropped out of school because she figured if there was something out there that had that much power over you and could do with you at will, then what was the purpose of even trying to do anything? And of course, over time she came to recognize that was a fruitless behavior, but rarely did I encounter that.
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating work, and I'm glad to hear that there may be some more down the road.
Oh, yes, there will be.
Well, that's fantastic, Dr. Clark.
And right now there's a look at perhaps even translating it into Japanese, of all things.
Wow, that's great. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So Japanese and probably Spanish has got to be on the table too, right, with all your...
I don't know. I haven't heard anything, but I certainly have been in contact with some people who are interested in publishing it in Japan. And I've just referred them to my editor, and I think you know him, Patrick.
At the Anomalous Press.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Nice folks over there. Great folks. And they have some great books.
Yeah.
Well, again, the book is Encounters with Star People, Untold Story of American Indians. A fascinating book. Dr. Clark, it's been great having you on. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
My pleasure. I enjoy talking to you.
Thanks again to Dr. Clark for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of questions I might tee up for our discussion following this interview. The first would have to do with the question that's been on my mind for a while since I've been thinking about this topic, and that is, what is the connection between spirituality and the spirit world and alien contact experience? We approached that area a couple times in this discussion. I think it's something that is for the most part lacking within the UFO community and certainly within the spiritual community. I think it's a real fertile area to look at and question. So that would be topic number one. And that kind of leads into the second topic, and that is, why is there this compartmentalization between these disciplines that are on the fringe, if you will? They would naturally seem to be more aligned, and yet they're not. We have compartmentalization within UFO communities that don't want to consider alien contact, don't want to consider consciousness, certainly don't want to consider anything spiritual. We have compartmentalization within the parapsychology community, which I've talked about before, is just stunning that people who consider themselves parapsychologists or interested in parapsychology have no interest in near-death experience or spiritually transformative experiences. That seems totally bizarre, and yet it exists, and it's an interesting parallel with the UFO community, where people want to consider saucers and lights in the sky, but as soon as someone talks about contact, let alone some kind of spiritually transformative UFO experience, they're out the door. So the question is, what's going on there? Why do we compartmentalize these different areas that, if you're accepting at all of them, seem to have obvious connections? So those are a couple of questions to chew on, think about, and of course, if you are willing, share your thoughts with the rest of us. The place to do that is at the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can jump on over to our forum, leave a comment on the comment section of the website, or drop an email or a Facebook note to me. Well, that's going to do it for today. I have a number of interesting shows coming up, and I certainly hope you'll stay with me for all of those. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.